led him to the dining area, where drinks were waiting. Just two pals, arm in arm.
"We are worried, Rick," he was saying, suddenly very serious.
A pause. "Worried about what?"
"This game. We are so close."
He unwrapped himself and poured two glasses of white wine.
"You are a great football player, Rick. The best ever in Parma, maybe in all of Italy. A real NFL quarterback. Can you tell us, Rick, that we will win the Super Bowl?"
The women were on the patio, looking at flowers in a window box.
"No one is that smart, Tommy. The game is too unpredictable."
"But you, Rick, you've seen so much, so many great players in magnificent stadiums. You know the real game, Rick. Surely you know if we can win."
"We can win, yes."
"But do you promise?"
Tommy smiled and thumped Rick on the chest. "Come on, buddy, just between the two of us. Tell me what I want to hear."
"I believe strongly that we will win the next two games, thus the Super Bowl. But Tommy, only a fool would promise that."
"Mr. Joe Namath guaranteed it, what, in Super Bowl 3 or 4?
"Super Bowl 3, and I'm not Joe Namath."
Tommy was so thoroughly non-traditional that he did not provide Parmigiano cheese and prosciutto ham to nibble on while they waited on dinner. His wine came from Spain. Maddalena served salads of spinach and tomato, then small portions of a baked cod dish that would never be found in a cookbook from Emilio Romano. Not a trace of pasta anywhere. Dessert was a dry, brittle biscuit, dark as in chocolate, but practically tasteless. For the first time in Parma, Rick left the table hungry. After weak coffee and prolonged goodbyes, they left and stopped for a large gelato on the walk home.
"He's a creep," Livy said. "His hands were all over me."
"Can't blame him for that."
"Shut up."
"And besides, I was groping Maddalena."
"You were not, because I watched every move."
"Jealous?"
"Extremely."
She shoved a spoonful of pistachio between his lips and said, without a smile,
"Do you hear me, Reek? I am insanely jealous."
"Yes, ma'am."
And with that, they passed another little milestone, took another step together. From flirting to casual sex to a more intense variety. From quick emails to much longer chats by phone. From a long-distance romance to playing house. From an uncertain near future to one that just might be shared. And now, an agreement on exclusivity. Monogamy. All sealed with a mouthful of pistachio gelato. Coach Russo was fed up with all the Super Bowl talk. Friday night, he yelled at his team that if they didn't get serious about Bologna, a team they had lost to, by the way, they would not be playing the Super Bowl. One game at a time, you idiots. And he yelled again on Saturday as they sped through a light workout, one that Nino and Franco demanded they have. Every player showed up, most of them an hour early. At 10 the following morning, they left for Bologna by bus. They had a light lunch of sandwiches at a cafeteria on the edge of town, and at 1:30, the Panthers got off the bus and walked across the best football field in Italy. Bologna has 500,000 people and a lot of fans of American football. The Warriors have a long tradition of good teams, active youth leagues, and solid owners, and their field, likewise an old rugby pitch, has been upgraded to football specs and is carefully maintained. Before the rise of Bergamo, Bologna dominated the league. Two charter buses filled with Parma fans arrived after the team and made a rowdy entrance into the stadium. Before long, the two sides were engaged in a rousing shouting match. Banners went up. Rick noticed one on the Bologna side that read, "Cook the Goat." According to Livy, Bologna was famous for its food and, not surprisingly, claimed to have the best cuisine in all of Italy. Perhaps goat was a regional specialty. In their first meeting, Trey Colby caught 3 touchdown passes in the first quarter. By halftime, he had 4. Then his career ended early in the third quarter. Ray Montrose, a tailback who'd played at Rutgers and had easily won the regular season rushing title at 228 yards a game, romped around and threw the Panther defense for 3 touchdowns and 200 yards. Bologna won 35-34. Since then, the Panthers had not lost, nor had they played in a close game. Nor did Rick expect one today. Bologna was a one-man team, all Montrose. The quarterback was the typical small college type. Tough, but a step slow, and erratic even in the short game. The third American was a safety from Dartmouth,
who had been pitifully unable to cover Trey, and Trey was neither as quick nor as fast as Fabrizio. The game would be exciting and high-scoring, and Rick wanted the ball first. But the Warriors won the toss, and when the teams lined up for the opening kick, the stands were full and rocking. The return man was a tiny Italian. Rick had noticed on tape that he often held the ball low, away from his body, a no-no that would keep him on every bench in America. "Strip the ball!" Sam had screamed 1,000 times during the week. "If number 8 takes the kick, strip the damn ball!" But first they had to catch him. As number 8 slashed across midfield, he could smell goal line. The ball came away from his gut as he took it in his right hand. Silvio, the pint-sized linebacker with great speed, caught him from the side and jerked his right arm almost out of its socket, and the ball began rolling on the ground. A panther recovered it. Montrose would have to wait. On the first play, Rick faked to Franco on a dive, then pump-faked to Fabrizio on a 5-and-out. The corner, sniffing an early and dramatic interception, took the bait, and when Fabrizio spun upfield, he was wide open for a long second. Rick threw the ball much too hard, but Fabrizio knew what was coming. He took it with his fingers, absorbed it with his upper body, then clutched it just as the safety closed in for the kill. But the safety never caught him. Fabrizio spun again, hit the afterburners, and was soon strutting across the goal line. 7-0. To further prolong the entrance of Mr. Montrose, Sam called for an onside kick. They had practiced it dozens of times in the past week. Filippo, their big-footed kicker, nicked the top of the ball perfectly, and it bounced crazily across midfield. Franco and Pietro thundered behind it, not to touch it, but to annihilate the nearest two Warriors. They flattened two confused boys who'd been drifting back for the wedge, then changed gears and were going timidly for the kick. Giancarlo somersaulted over the pile and landed on the ball. 3 plays later, Fabrizio was back in the end zone. Montrose finally got the ball on a 1st-and-10 from the 31. The pitch to the tailback was as predictable as a sunrise, and Sam sent everybody but the free safety, just in case. A massive gang tackle ensued, but Montrose still managed to gain 3. Then 5, and 4, and 3 again. His runs were short, his yardage fought for against a swarming defense. On a 3rd-and-1, Bologna finally tried something creative. Sam called another blitz, and when the quarterback yanked the ball out of Montrose's belly and looked for a receiver, he found one all alone, dancing down the far sideline, waving his arms and screaming because there wasn't a panther within 20 yards of him. The pass was long and high, and when the receiver caught up to it at the 10-yard line, the home fans stood and cheered. Both hands grabbed the ball. Then both hands let it slip away, painfully, slowly, as if in suspended motion. The receiver lunged for the prize of gold as it bobbled too far from his fingertips, then fell flat on his face at the 5-yard line and slapped the grass. You could almost hear him cry. The punter averaged 28 yards a kick and managed to lower this by shanking one at his own fans. Rick sprinted the offense onto the field and with no huddle ran 3 straight plays to Fabrizio. A slant across the middle for 12 yards, a curl for 11, and a post for 34 yards and the 3rd touchdown in the first 4 minutes of the game. Bologna didn't panic and abandon its game plan. Montrose got the ball on every play, and on every play Sam blitzed at least 9 defenders. The result was a slugfest as the offense methodically punched the ball down the field. When Montrose scored from 3 yards out, the first quarter expired. The second quarter was more of the same. Rick and his offense scored easily while Montrose and his grounded out. At the half, the Panthers led 38-13, and Sam struggled for something to complain about. Montrose had 2 touchdowns on 21 carries and almost 200 yards, but who cared? Sam lectured them with the usual coach speak about second-half collapses, but it was a lame performance. The truth was that Sam had never seen a team at any level coalesce so beautifully and effortlessly after such a lousy start. To be certain, his quarterback was a fish out of water, and Fabrizio was not just good, but great and worth every penny of his 800 euros a month. But the Panthers had stepped up to another level. Franco and Giancarlo ran with authority and daring. Nino, Paolo the Aggie, and Giorgio fired off the ball and seldom missed a block. Rick was rarely sacked or even pressured. And the defense, with Pietro clogging the middle and Silvio blitzing with total abandon, had become a frenzy of gang tacklers, swarming around the ball on every play like a pack of dogs. From somewhere, probably from the presence of their quarterback, the Panthers had obtained a cocky self-assurance that coaches dream about, They had the swagger now. This was their season, and they would not lose again. They scored on the opening drive of the second half without throwing a pass. Giancarlo zipped wide left and wide right while Franco thundered through the pit. The drive ate 6 minutes, and with the score 45-13, Montrose and company jogged onto the field with a sense of defeat. He didn't quit, but after 30 carries, he lost a step. After 35, he had his fourth touchdown, but the mighty Warriors were too far behind. The final was 51-27. Chapter 28. In the early hours of Monday morning, Livy hopped out of bed, turned on a light, and announced, "We're going to Venice."
"No," came the response from under the pillow.
"Yes, you've never been. Venice is my favorite city."
"So is Rome and Florence and Siena."
"Get up, lover boy. I'm showing you Venice."
"No, I'm too sore."
"What a wimp. I'm going to Venice to find me a real man, a soccer player."
"Let's go back to sleep."
"Nope. I'm leaving. I guess I'll take the train."
"Send me a postcard."
She slapped him across the rump and headed for the shower. An hour later, the Fiat was loaded and Rick was hauling back coffee and croissants from his neighborhood bar. Coach Russo had canceled practice until Friday. The Super Bowl, like its American imitator, took 2 weeks to prepare for. To no one's surprise, the opponent was Bergamo. Outside the city, away from the morning traffic, Livy began with the history of Venice, and mercifully hit only the high points for the first 2,000 years. Rick listened with his hand on her knees as she went on about how and why the city was built on mud banks and tidal areas and floods all the time. She referred to her guidebooks occasionally, but much of it came from memory. She had been there twice in the past year for long weekends. The first time she was with a gaggle of students, which inspired her to return a month later by herself.
"And the streets are rivers?" Rick asked, more than a little concerned about the Fiat and where it might get parked.
"Better known as canals. There are no cars, only boats."
"Those little boats are called..."
"Gondolas."
"Gondolas. I saw a movie once where this couple went for a ride in a gondola and the little captain..."
"Gondolier?"
"Whatever. But he kept singing real loud and they couldn't get him to shut up. Pretty funny. It was a comedy."
"That's for the tourists."
"Can't wait."
"Venice is the most unique city in the world, Rick. I want you to love it."
"Oh, I'm sure I will. Wonder if they have a football team."
"There's no mention of one in the guidebooks."
Her phone was off, and she seemed unconcerned about events back home. Rick knew her parents were furious and making threats, but there was much more to the saga than she had so far divulged. Livy could turn it off like a switch, and when she buried herself in the history and art and culture of Italy, she was once again a student, thrilled with her subject and anxious to share it.
They stopped for lunch outside the city of Padua. An hour later, they found a commercial lot for tourists with cars and parked the Fiat for 20 euros a day. In Mestre, they caught a ferry, and their adventure on the water began. The ferry rocked as it was loaded, then lunged across the Venetian lagoon. Livy clutched him along the top rail and watched with great anticipation as Venice drew closer. Soon they were entering the Grand Canal, and boats were everywhere. Private water taxis, small barges laden with produce and goods, the Carabinieri wagon with police insignia, a vaporetto loaded with tourists, fishing boats, other ferries, and finally, gondolas by the dozen. The murky water lapped at the front steps of elegant palazzi built door to door. The campanile at Piazza San Marco loomed high in the distance. Rick couldn't help but notice the domes of dozens of old churches, and he had a sinking feeling he would become familiar with most of them. They exited at a ferry stop near the Gritti Palace. On the boardwalk, she said, "This is the only bad part of Venice. We have to roll our luggage to the hotel." And roll they did, down the crowded streets, over the narrow footbridges, through alleys cut off from the sun. She had warned him to pack light, though her bag was still twice as large as his. The hotel was a quaint little guest house, tucked away from the tourists. The owner, Signora Stella, was a spry woman in her 70s, who worked the front desk and pretended to remember Livy from 4 months back. She put them in a corner room, tight quarters, but a nice view of the skyline, cathedrals all around, and also a full bath, which, as Livy explained, was not always the case in these tiny hotels in Italy. The bed rattled as Rick stretched out, and this concerned him briefly. She was not in the mood, not with Venice lying before them and so much to see. He couldn't even negotiate a nap. He did manage, however, to negotiate a truce. His limit would be 2 cathedrals, palaces per day. After that, she was on her own. They wandered over to Piazza San Marco, the first stop for all visitors, and spent the first hour at a sidewalk cafe sipping drinks and watching large waves of students and tourists drift around the magnificent square. It had been built 400 years earlier, when Venice was a rich and powerful city-state, she was saying. The Doge's palace occupied one corner, a huge fortress that had been protecting Venice for at least 700 years. The church, or basilica, was vast and attracted the biggest crowds. She left to buy tickets, and Rick called Sam. The coach was watching the tape of yesterday's game between Bergamo and Milan, the usual Monday afternoon chore for any coach prepping for the Super Bowl. "Where are you?" Sam demanded. "Venice. With that young girl?" "She's 21, coach, and yes, she's close by." "Bergamo was impressive. No fumbles, only 2 penalties, won by 3 touchdowns. They seem much better now that the streak is off their backs." "And Maschi?" "Brilliant. He knocked out their quarterback in the 3rd quarter." "I've been knocked out before. I suspect they'll put the 2 Americans on Fabrizio and pound him. Could be a long day for the boy. There goes the passing game. Maschi can shut down the run." "Thank God for the punting game," Sam sneered. "You got a plan?" "I got a plan. Mind sharing it with me so I can sleep tonight?" "No, it's not finished yet. Couple more days in Venice, and I'll have the kinks worked out. Let's meet Thursday afternoon and work on it."
"Sure, coach."
Rick and Livy trudged through the Basilica of San Marco, shoulder to shoulder with some Dutch tourists, their guide prattling on in any language requested. After an hour, Rick bolted. He drank a beer in the fading sun at a cafe and waited patiently for Livy. They strolled through central Venice and crossed the Rialto Bridge without buying anything. For the daughter of a rich doctor, she was behaving frugally. Tiny hotels, cheap meals, trains and ferries, an apparent concern with what things cost. She insisted on paying for half of everything, or at least offering. Rick told her more than once that he was certainly not wealthy, nor was he highly paid, but he refused to worry about money, and he refused to let her pay for much. Their metal-framed bed rocked halfway across the room during a late-night session, enough noise to prompt Signora Stella to whisper something discreetly to Livy during breakfast the next morning.
"What did she say?" Rick asked when Stella disappeared.
Livy, suddenly blushing, leaned in and whispered,
"We made too much noise last night. There were complaints."
"What did you tell her?"
"Too bad. We can't stop."
"Atta girl."
"She doesn't think we should, but she might move us to another room, one with a heavier bed."
"I love a challenge."
Long boulevards do not exist in Venice. The streets are narrow, and they twist and curl with the canals and cross them with a variety of bridges. Someone once counted 400 bridges in the city, and by late Wednesday, Rick was certain he had used them all. He was parked under an umbrella at a sidewalk cafe, puffing languidly on a Cuban cigar and sipping Campari and ice, waiting for Livy to polish off another cathedral, this one known as the Church of San Fantin. He wasn't tired of her, just the opposite. Her energy and curiosity inspired him to use his brain. She was a delightful companion, easy to please, and eager to do whatever looked like fun. He was still waiting for a glimpse of the pampered rich kid, the self-absorbed sorority queen. Maybe it didn't exist. Nor was he tired of Venice. In fact, he was enchanted by the city and its endless nooks and dead ends and hidden piazzas. The seafood was incredible, and he was thoroughly enjoying this break from pasta. He'd seen enough cathedrals and palazzi and museums, but his interest in the city's art and history had been piqued. Rick was a football player, though, and there was one game remaining. It was a game he had to win to justify his presence, his existence, and his cost, meager as it was. Money aside, he had once been an NFL quarterback, and if he couldn't put together an offense for one more win here in Italy, then it was time to hang up the spikes. He had already dropped the hint that he needed to leave Thursday morning. She seemed to ignore it. Over dinner at Fiore, he said,
"I need to go to Parma tomorrow. Coach Russo wants to meet me in the afternoon."
"I think I'll stay here,"
she said without hesitation. It was all planned.
"For how long?"
"A few more days. I'll be fine."
And he had no doubt she would be. Though they preferred to stick together,
Both needed their space, and each was quick to disappear. Livy could travel the world alone much easier than he could. Nothing flustered or intimidated her. She adjusted on the fly like any seasoned traveler and was not above using her smile and beauty to get what she wanted.
"You'll be back for the Super Bowl?" he asked.
"I wouldn't dare miss it."
Smartass. They had eel, mullet, and cuttlefish, and when they were stuffed, they walked to Harry's bar on the Grand Canal for a nightcap. They sat huddled in a corner, watching a crowd of loud Americans and not missing home.
"When the season is over, what will you do?" she asked.
She was wrapped around his right arm, and his right hand massaged her knees. They sipped slowly, as if they might be there all night.
"I'm not sure." "What about you?" he asked.
"I need to go home, but I don't want to."
"I don't need to, and I don't want to, but I'm not quite clear on what I'm supposed to do here."
"You want to stay?"
she asked, as she somehow managed to get even closer.
"With you?"
"Got anybody else in mind?"
"That's not what I meant. Are you staying?"
"I could be talked into it."
The heavier bed was in a larger room and solved the problem of complaints. They slept late Thursday, then said an uncomfortable goodbye. Rick waved to her as the ferry shoved off and eased through the Grand Canal. Chapter 29. The sound was vaguely familiar. He'd heard it before, but from the depths of his coma he could not remember where or when. He sat up in bed, saw that it was 4 minutes after 3 a.m., and finally put things together. Someone was at his door.
"Coming," he growled, and his intruder removed her thumb from the white button in the hallway.
Rick pulled on gym shorts and a t-shirt. He flipped on lights and suddenly remembered Detective Romo and the non-arrest months earlier. He thought of Franco, his own personal judge, and decided he had nothing to fear.
"Who is it?"
he said to the door, his mouth close to the latch.
"I'd like to talk to you."
Deep, scratchy voice, American, hint of a twang.
"Okay, we're talking." "I'm looking for Rick Dockery."
"You found him. Now what?"
"Please, I need to see Livy Galloway."
"Are you a cop of some sort?" Rick suddenly thought of his neighbors and the commotion he was creating by yelling through a closed door.
"No."
Rick unbolted the door and came face to face with a barrel-chested man in a cheap black suit. Large head, thick mustache, heavy circles around the eyes. Probably a long history with the bottle. He thrust out a hand and said,
"I'm Lee Bryson, a private investigator from Atlanta."
"A pleasure," Rick said without shaking hands.
"Who's he?"
Behind Bryson was a sinister-faced Italian in a dark suit that cost a few bucks more than Bryson's.
"Lorenzo. He's from Milan."
"That really explains things. Is he a cop?"
"No."
"So we don't have any cops here, right?"
"No. We're private investigators. Please, if I could just have 10 minutes.
Rick waved them through and locked the door. He followed them into the den, where they awkwardly sat knee to knee on the sofa. He fell into a chair across the room.
"This better be good," he said. "I work for some lawyers in Atlanta, Mr. Dockery. Can I call you Rick?"
"No."
"Okay. These lawyers are involved in the divorce between Dr. Galloway and Mrs. Galloway, and they sent me here to see Livy."
"She's not here."
Bryson glanced around the room, and his eyes froze on a pair of red high heels on the floor near the television. Then a brown handbag on the end table. All that was missing was a bra hanging from the lamp, one with leopard print. Lorenzo stared only at Rick, as if his role was to handle the killing if it became necessary.
"I think she is," Bryson said.
"I don't care what you think. She's been here, but not now.
Mind if I look around?"
"Sure.
Just show me a search warrant and you can inspect the laundry." Bryson swiveled his massive head again.
"It's a small apartment," Rick said, "with 3 rooms. You can see 2 from where you're sitting. I promise you, Livy is not in there in the bedroom."
"Where is she?
Why do you want to know?"
"I was sent here to find her. That's my job. There are folks back home who are very concerned about her."
"Maybe she doesn't want to go home. Maybe she wants to avoid those same folks."
"Where is she?"
"She's fine. She likes to travel. You'll have a hard time finding her."
Bryson picked at his mustache and seemed to smile.
"She might find it difficult to travel," he said. "Her visa expired 3 days ago.
Rick absorbed this, but did not relent.
"That's not exactly a felony."
"No, but things could get sticky. She needs to come home.
Maybe so. You're welcome to explain all this to her, and when you do, I'm sure she'll make whatever decision she damn well pleases. She's a big girl, Mr. Bryson. Very capable of running her own life. She doesn't need you, me, or anyone back home.
His nighttime raid had failed, and Bryson began his withdrawal. He yanked some papers out of his coat pocket, tossed them on the coffee table, then said, with an effort at drama,
"Here's the deal. That's a one-way ticket from Rome to Atlanta this Sunday. She shows up, no one asks questions about the visa. That little problem has been taken care of. She doesn't show. Then she's AWOL here, without proper documentation."
"Oh, that's really swell, but you're talking to the wrong person. As I just said, Ms. Galloway makes her own decisions. I just provide a room when she passes through."
"But you will talk to her?"
"Maybe, but there's no guarantee I'll see her before Sunday, or next month for that matter. She likes to wander." There was nothing else for Bryson to do. He was being paid to find the girl, make some threats, scare her into coming home, and hand over the ticket. Beyond that, he had zero authority, on Italian soil or otherwise. He climbed to his feet, with Lorenzo following every movement. Rick stayed in his chair. At the door, Bryson stopped and said,
"I'm a Falcons fan. Didn't you pass through Atlanta a few years ago?"
"Yes," Rick said quickly and without elaboration. Bryson glanced around the apartment. Third floor, no elevator, ancient building on a narrow street in an ancient city, a long way from the bright lights of the NFL. Rick held his breath and waited for the cheap shot. Maybe something like, "I guess you finally found your place," or "Nice career move." Instead, he filled the gap with, "How did you find me?" As Bryson opened the door, he said, "One of her roommates remembered your name." It was almost noon before she answered her phone. She was having lunch outdoors at Piazza San Marco and feeding the pigeons. Rick replayed the scene with Bryson. Her initial reaction was one of anger. How dare her parents track her down and force themselves into her life? Anger at the lawyers who hired the thugs who barged into Rick's apartment at such an hour. Anger at her roommate for squealing. When she settled down, curiosity took over as she debated which parent was behind it. It was impossible to think they were working together. Then she remembered that her father had lawyers in Atlanta, while her mother's were from Savannah. When she finally asked his opinion, Rick, who'd thought of little else for hours, said that she should take the ticket and go home. Once there, she could work through the visa issue and hopefully return as soon as possible.
"You don't understand," she said more than once, and he truly did not. Her baffling explanation was that she could never use the ticket sent by her father, because he had managed to manipulate her for 21 years, and she was fed up. If she returned to the United States, it would be on her own terms.
"I would never use that ticket, and he knows it," she said. Rick frowned and scratched his head and was once again thankful for a dull and simple family. And not for the first time, he asked himself, how damaged might this girl be? What about the expired visa? Well, not surprisingly, she had a plan. Italy, being Italy, had some loopholes in the immigration laws, one of which was called the permesso di soggiorno, or a permit to stay. It was sometimes granted to legal aliens whose visas had expired and typically ran for another 90 days. She was wondering if Judge Franco perhaps knew someone in immigration, or maybe Signor Bruncardo. And what about Tommy, the career civil servant, the defensive end who couldn't cook? Surely someone in the Panthers organization could find a string to pull. A wonderful idea, thought Rick. And even more likely if they won the Super Bowl.
Chapter 30. Last-minute wrangling with the cable company pushed the kickoff back to 8 o'clock Saturday night. Televising the game live, even on a lesser channel, was important for the league and the sport, and a Super Bowl under the lights meant a bigger gate and a rowdier crowd. By late afternoon, parking lots around the stadium were filled as football diehards celebrated the Italian version of the tailgate. Buses of fans arrived from Parma and Bergamo. Banners were stretched along the edges of the field, soccer style. A miniature hot air balloon hovered over the field. As always, it was the biggest day of the year for football americano, and its small but loyal base of fans arrived in Milan for the final game. The site was a beautifully maintained little arena used by a local soccer league. For the occasion, the nets were gone and the field was meticulously striped, even down to the sideline hash marks. One end zone was painted black and white with the word Parma in the center. 100, exactly, yards away, the Bergamo end zone was gold and black. There were pregame speeches by league officials and introductions of former greats, a ceremonial coin toss won by the Lions, and a prolonged announcing of the starting lineups. When the teams finally lined up for the opening kick, both sidelines were hopping with nerves and the crowd was crazy. Even Rick, the cool, unflustered quarterback, was stomping the sideline, slapping shoulder pads, and screaming for blood. This was football the way it was meant to be. Bergamo ran three plays and punted. The Panthers did not have another kill Mosky play ready. Mosky wasn't that stupid. In fact, the more tape Rick watched, the more he admired and feared the middle linebacker. He could wreck an offense, just like the great LT. On first down, Fabrizio was double-teamed by the two Americans, McGregor and the Professor, just as Rick and Sam expected. A wise move for Bergamo, and the beginning of a rough day for Rick in the offense. He called a sideline route. Fabrizio caught the ball and was shoved out by the Professor, then nailed in the back by McGregor. But there were no flags. Rick jumped an official while Nino and Carl the Dane went after McGregor. Sam charged onto the field, screaming and cursing in Italian, and promptly drew a personal foul. The refs managed to prevent a brawl, but the brouhaha went on for minutes. Fabrizio was okay and limped back to the huddle. On a 2nd and 20, Rick pitched wide to Giancarlo, and Mosky slapped his ankles together at the line. Between plays, Rick continued to bitch at the referee, while Sam chewed on the back judge. On 3rd and long, Rick decided to give the ball to Franco, and perhaps survive the traditional first-quarter fumble. Franco and Mosky collided hard, for old time's sake, and the play gained a couple with no change of possession. The 35 points they had put up against Bergamo a month earlier suddenly looked like a miracle. The team swapped punts as the defenses dominated. Fabrizio was smothered and, at 175 pounds, was getting shoved around on every play. Claudio dropped two short passes that were thrown much too hard. The first quarter ended with no score, and the crowd settled into a pretty dull game. Perhaps dull to watch, but along the line of scrimmage, the hitting was ferocious. Every play was the last of the season, and no one yielded an inch. On a bobbled snap, Rick raced around the right side, hoping to make it out of bounds, when Mosky appeared from thin air and nailed him, helmet to helmet. Rick jumped to his feet, no big deal, but on the sideline he rubbed his temples and tried to shake off the dust. "You okay?" Sam growled as he walked by. "Great. Then do something." "Right." But nothing worked. As they had feared, Fabrizio was neutralized, thus so was the passing game. And Mosky could not be controlled. He was too strong up the middle and too quick on the sweeps. He looked much better on the field than on the film. Each offense ground out a few first downs, but neither approached the red zone. The punting teams were growing tired. With 30 seconds to go before the half, the Bergamo kicker nailed a 42-yarder, and the Lions took a 3-0 lead into the locker room. Charlie Cray, 20 pounds lighter, his jaw still wired, gaunt with flesh sagging from his chin and cheeks, hid in the crowd, and during the half, pecked out some notes on his laptop. "Not a bad setting for a game, handsome stadium, well-decorated, enthusiastic crowd of maybe 5,000. Dockery could well be in over his head, even here in Italy. In the first half he was 3 for 8, 22 yards and no score. I must say, however, that this is real football. The hitting is brutal, tremendous hustle and desire. No one slacks. These guys are not playing for money, just pride, and it is a powerful incentive. Dockery is the only American on the Parma team, and you wonder if they would be better off without him. We shall see." There was no yelling in the locker room. Sam praised the defense for a superb effort. "Keep it up. We'll figure out a way to score." The coaches left, and the players spoke. Nino, first as always, in passionate praise of the heroic defensive efforts, then an exhortation to the offense to get some points. "This is our moment," he said. "Some of us may never be here again. Dig deep. Gut check." He wiped away tears when he was finished. Tommy stood and proclaimed his love for everyone in the room. This was his last game, he said,
and he desperately wanted to retire as a champion. Pietro walked to the center. This was not his last game, but he would be damned if his career would be determined by the boys from Bergamo. He boasted loudly that they would not score in the second half. As Franco was about to wrap things up, Rick stood beside him and raised his hand. With Franco translating, he said,
"Win or lose, I thank you for allowing me to play on your team this season."
Halt. Translation. The room was still. His teammates hung on every word.
"Win or lose, I am proud to be a Panther. One of you. Thank you for accepting me."
Translation.
"Win or lose, I consider all of you to be not just my friends, but my brothers."
Translation. Some appeared ready to cry.
"I've had more fun here than in the other NFL, and we are not going to lose this game."
When he finished, Franco bear-hugged him and the team cheered heartily. They clapped and slapped him on the back. Franco, eloquent as always, dwelled on history. No Parma team had ever won the Super Bowl, and the next hour would be their finest hour. They had thrashed Bergamo 4 weeks earlier, broken the mighty streak, sent them home in disgrace, and they could certainly beat them again. For Coach Russo and his quarterback, the first half had been perfect. Basic football, far removed from the complexities of the major college and pro games, can often be plotted like an ancient battle. A steady attack on one front can set the stage for a surprise on another. The same monotonous movements can lull the opponent to sleep. Early on, they had conceded the passing game. They had not been creative with the run. Bergamo had stopped everything and was confident there was nothing left. On the second play of the second half, Rick faked left to Franco on a dive, faked a pitch left to Giancarlo, then sprinted right on a naked bootleg. Maschi, always quick to the ball, was far to the left and badly out of position. Rick ran hard for 22 yards and stepped out of bounds to avoid McGregor. Sam met him as he jogged back to the huddle.
"That'll work. Save it for later."
3 plays later, the Panthers punted again. Pietro and Silvio sprinted onto the field, looking for someone to maul. They stuffed the run 3 times. More punts filled the air as the third quarter ticked away, and both teams slugged it out at midfield, much like two lumbering heavyweights in the center of the ring, taking shots, throwing leather, and never backing down. Early in the fourth, the Lions inched the ball all the way to the 19, their deepest penetration of the game, and on a 4th and 5, their kicker drilled an easy field goal. Down 6 points with 10 minutes to go, the Panthers' sideline rose to another level of panic and frenzy. Their fans followed along, and the atmosphere was electric.
"Showtime," Rick said to Sam as they watched the kickoff.
"Yep. Don't get hurt."
"Are you kidding? I've been knocked out by better men."
On first down, Rick pitched left to Giancarlo for 5 yards. On second, he faked the same pitch, kept the ball, and dashed wide around the right side, free and clear for 20 yards until McGregor came in low and hard. Rick lowered his head and met him in a sickening collision. Both scrambled to their feet. There was no time for cobwebs or rubbery knees. Giancarlo swept right and was decked by Maschi. Rick bootlegged left and picked up 15 before McGregor hit his knees. The only strategy to offset quickness is misdirection, and the offense suddenly had a different look. Backs in motion, 3 receivers on one side, 2 tight ends, new plays, and new formations. Under center, in the wishbone, Rick faked to Franco, turned upfield, then flipped to Giancarlo just as Maschi hit him low. A perfect option, and Giancarlo sprinted for 11 yards. From the shotgun, another naked bootleg, and Rick ran out of bounds at the 18. Maschi was guessing now, not simply reacting. He had more to think about. McGregor and the professor had backed off Fabrizio a step or two, suddenly under pressure to stop the scrambling quarterback. 7 tough plays moved the ball to the 3, and on 4th and goal, Filippo kicked an easy field goal. Bergamo led 6-3 with 6 minutes to go. Alex Oliveto huddled with the defense before the kickoff. He cursed and slapped helmets and had a fine time firing up the troops. Perhaps a bit too much. On 2nd down, Pietro speared the quarterback and gave up 15 precious yards on the personal foul. The drive stalled at midfield, and a great punt stopped rolling at the 5. 95 yards to go in 3 minutes.
Rick avoided Sam as he trotted onto the field. He saw fear in the huddle, and he told them to relax. No fumbles, no penalties, just hit hard, and they would soon be in the end zone. No translation was needed. Maskey taunted him as they came to the line.
You can do it, goat. Throw me a pass.
Instead, he pitched to Giancarlo, who clutched the ball tightly and hopped for 5 yards. On second down, he rolled right, looked for Fabrizio across the middle, saw too many gold jerseys, and tucked the ball. Franco, bless his soul, broke from the pile and put a nasty block on Maskey. Rick picked up 14 yards and got out of bounds. On first down, he rolled right again, tucked the ball and sprinted upfield. Fabrizio was loafing on a curl, useless as he had been throughout the game, and when Rick scrambled, he took off, sprinting at full throttle, with McGregor and the professor far behind. Rick stopped just inches from the line. Maskey was slashing in for the kill. It was that moment in every game when the quarterback, unprotected and vulnerable, sees an open receiver and has a split second to make a choice. Throw the pass and risk a bruising tackle, or yank the ball down and run for safety. Rick planted his feet and threw the ball as far as he possibly could. After the launch, Maskey's helmet landed under his chin and almost broke his jaw. The pass was a tight spiral, so high and so long that the crowd gasped in disbelief. It had the hang time of a perfect punt, a few long seconds in which everyone froze. Everyone except Fabrizio, who was flying and trying to find the ball. At first, it was impossible to gauge where it might land, but they had practiced this Hail Mary 100 times. Just get to the end zone, Rick always said. The ball will be there. As it began its descent, Fabrizio realized more speed was needed. He pumped even harder, his feet barely touching the grass. At the 5-yard line, he left the ground much like an Olympic long jumper and sailed through the air, arms fully extended, fingers grasping for the ball. He touched leather at the goal line, hit the ground hard, bounced up like an acrobat, and waved the ball for the world to see. And everyone saw it but Rick, who was on all fours, rocking back and forth, trying to remember who he was. As a loud roar erupted, Franco picked him up and dragged him to the sideline where his teammates mobbed him. Rick managed to stay on his feet, but not without assistance. Sam figured he was dead, but was too stunned by the catch to react to his quarterback. Flags flew as the celebration spilled onto the field. The officials finally restored order and marked off 15 yards. Then Filippo crushed an extra point that would have been good from midfield. Charlie Cray would write, "The ball traveled 76 yards in the air without the slightest hint of a wobble, but the pass itself paled in greatness to the catch at the other end. I've witnessed great touchdowns, but frankly, sports fans, this one tops the list. A skinny Italian named Fabrizio Benozzi saved Dockery from another humiliating defeat." Filippo stuck his supercharged foot into the kickoff, and it soared over the end zone. On a 3rd and long, old Tommy spun around the left tackle and sacked the quarterback. His last play as a Panther was his greatest. On 4th and even longer, the Bergamo quarterback bobbled a bad shotgun snap and finally fell on the ball at the 5-yard line. The Panthers' sideline erupted again, and their fans managed to scream even louder. With 50 seconds on the clock, and with Rick on the bench sniffing ammonia, Alberto took over the offense and simply fell on the ball twice. Time expired, and the Panthers of Parma had their first Super Bowl trophy. Chapter 31. They gathered triumphantly at Mario's, an old pizzeria in north-central Milan, 20 minutes from the stadium. Signor Bruncardo rented out the entire place for the celebration, an expensive proposition he might have regretted had they lost. But they certainly did not, and they arrived in buses and cabs, whooping as they walked in the front door and looking for beer. The players were given 3 long tables in the center of the room and were soon surrounded by their admirers, wives, girlfriends, fans from Parma. A videotape was inserted, and on giant screens the game played on as waiters hauled in dozens of pizzas and gallons of beer. Everyone had a camera, and 1,000 photos were taken. Rick was a favorite target, and he was hugged and squeezed and pawed until his shoulders were sore. Fabrizio was also the center of attention, especially with the teenage girls. The catch had already taken on legendary status. Rick's neck, chin, jaws, and forehead were throbbing, and his ears still rang. Matteo, the trainer, gave him pain pills that didn't mix with alcohol, so he laid off the beer. And he had no appetite. The video skipped the huddles, timeouts, and halftime, and as the end of the game approached, the noise died considerably. The operator switched to slow motion, and as Rick rolled out of the pocket and faked the run, the pizzeria was silent. The hit by Mosky was of highlight quality, and in the United States would have sent the talking heads into a drooling frenzy. The Monday morning cable shows would trumpet it as their hit of the day and run it every 10 minutes. In Mario's, though, there was a moment of silence for the dead as their quarterback held his ground, sacrificed his body, and launched his bomb. There were a few muted groans as Mosky knocked him senseless, all very clean and legal and astoundingly brutal. But there was rejoicing on the other end. The catch was captured beautifully and permanently on film, and watching it for the second time, then the third, was almost as exhilarating as seeing it live. Fabrizio, atypically, acted as though it was no big deal, just another day at the office. Many more where that came from. When the pizza was gone and the game was off, the crowd settled in for a few formalities. After a long speech by Signor Bruncardo and a short one by Sam, the two posed with the Super Bowl trophy and the greatest moment in Panthers history. When the drinking songs began, Rick knew it was time to leave. A long night was about to become much longer. He eased from the pizzeria, found a cab, and returned to the hotel. 2 days later, he met Sam for lunch at Sorel Picci, on Strada Farini, his neighborhood. They had some business to discuss, but first they rehashed the game. Since Sam wasn't working, they split a bottle of Lambrusco with their stuffed pasta. "When are you going home?" Sam asked.
"No plans. I'm in no hurry."
"That's unusual. Normally the Americans book a flight the day after the last game. You're not homesick?"
"I need to see my folks, but home is a fuzzy concept these days."
Sam chewed slowly on a spoonful of pasta.
"You thought about next year?"
"Not really."
"Can we talk about it?"
"We can talk about anything. You're buying lunch."
"Signor Bruncardo is buying lunch, and he's in a very good mood these days. He loves to win. Loves the press, the pictures, the trophies. And he wants to repeat things next year."
"I'm sure he does."
Sam refilled both glasses. "Your agent, what's his name?"
"Arnie."
"Arnie, is he still in the picture?"
"No."
"Good, so we can talk business?"
"Sure."
Bruncardo is offering 2,500 euros a month for 12 months, plus the apartment and the car for a year. Rick took a long pull on his wine and studied the red checkered tablecloth. Sam continued. "He'd rather give you the money than spend it on more Americans. He asked me if we can win again next year with the same team. I said yes."
"You agree?"
Rick nodded his agreement with a smirk.
"So he's sweetening your deal?"
"That's not a bad contract,"
Rick said, thinking less about the salary and more about the apartment that was now apparently needed by two people. He also thought about Silvio, who worked on the family farm, and Filippo, who drove a cement truck. They would kill for such a deal, and they practiced and played as hard as Rick. But they were not quarterbacks, were they? Another sip of wine, and he thought about the $400,000 Buffalo paid him when he signed 6 years earlier. And he thought about Randall Framer, a teammate at Seattle who was given $85 million to throw passes for 7 more years. Everything is relative.
"Look, Sam, 6 months ago they carried me off the field in Cleveland. I woke up 24 hours later in a hospital. My third concussion. The doctor suggested I give up football. My mother begged me to quit. Last Sunday, I woke up in the dressing room. I stayed on my feet, walked off the field. I suppose I celebrated with everyone else. But I don't remember it, Sam. I was knocked out again. Number 4. I don't know how many more I can survive."
"I understand.
I took some shots this season.
It's still football, and Mosky hit me as hard as anybody in the NFL.
Are you quitting?"
"I don't know.
Give me some time to think, to clear my head. I'm going to a beach for a few weeks."
"Where?"
My travel consultant has decided on Apulia, way down south, the heel of the Italian boot.
Been there?
No. This would be Livy?
Yes.
And the visa thing?
She's not worried.
Are you kidnapping her?
It's a joint kidnapping.
They boarded the train early and sat in the heat as other passengers hurried on. Livy sat across from him, her shoes already kicked off, her feet in his lap. Orange polish, short skirt, miles of legs. She was unfolding a schedule of train routes in southern Italy. She had asked for his input, his thoughts, wishes, and when he offered little, she was pleased. They would spend a week in Apulia, then ferry to Sicily for 10 days, then catch a boat to the island of Sardinia. As August approached, they would head north, away from the vacationers and the heat, and explore the mountains of the Veneto and Friuli. She wanted to see the cities of Verona, Vicenza, and Padua. She wanted to see it all. They would stay in hostels and cheap hotels, using his passport only until her little visa problem was fixed. Franco was hard at work on that challenge. They would take trains and ferries, cabs only when necessary. She had plans, alternative plans, and more plans. Rick's only deal-breaker had been his demand that 2 cathedrals per day was the limit. She negotiated, but finally relented. But there were no plans beyond August. Any thoughts about her family sent her into a funk, so she was trying to forget the mess back home. While she spoke less and less about her parents, she talked more about delaying her last year of college. Fine with Rick. As he massaged her feet, he told himself that he would follow those legs anywhere. The train was half full. Other men couldn't help but gawk as they shuffled by. Livy was off in southern Italy, wonderfully oblivious to the attention her bare feet and tanned legs were getting. As the Eurostar moved away from the platform, Rick watched through his window and waited. They soon passed Stadio Lanfranchi, less than 200 feet from the North End Zone, or whatever it was called in the rugby rulebook. He allowed himself a smile of deep satisfaction. This is Christopher Evan Welch. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Playing for Pizza by John Grisham. This program was directed by Karen DiMattia. Executive producer, Dan Zitt. This program was edited at John Marshall Sound. Text copyright 2007 by Belfry Holdings, Inc. Production copyright 2007, Random House, Inc. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.